Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Wicker.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, a woman is suing Milwaukee County for how she was treated during her pregnancy at the county jail. We'll learn more about the case.
First, today was the 13th annual State of the Tribes Address at the Wisconsin Capitol. Shannon Holsey, president of the Stockbridge-Munsee community, delivered the address to legislators at the Capitol this afternoon.
We're getting analysis now of the speech from Janice Rice and Patty Lowe. Janice Rice is a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation and was the outreach coordinator for the college library at UW-Madison until her retirement in 2015. She was also an archivist for the Ho-Chunk people, and she's a past president of the American Indian Library Association. And Patty Lowe is a professor in the UW-Madison Department of Life Sciences Communication and the School of Human Ecology. She's an enrolled member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe, and she's an affiliated faculty with the American Indian Studies Program. She's written several books on the Native American experience and history in Wisconsin. Janice, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Patty, welcome back. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Patty, let's start with you. Is there any significance in the fact that the Stockbridge-Munsee community president, Shannon Holsey, delivered this year's address?
Well, the State of the Tribes address is delivered by tribal chairs or presidents on a rotating basis. So this was the Mohican Nation, Stockbridge-Munsee community's time for that. So it wasn't significant in terms of, you know, why it was the Mohicans. It was just their turn.
And how did you see her speech received?
Well, you know, I've been attending these for quite a few years, and I always like to, you know, quantify the applause interruptions. And she was interrupted 31 times by applause from the state legislators and received 7 standing ovations. And Janice, I'm trying to think back. I know you and I have watched this a couple of times. And do you remember that kind of endorsement from the state legislature before? I don't either.
They were the first to stand up. Sometimes in the past, it's been the audience stands first, mm-hmm. even though we're not supposed to, and then they follow suit. But it's this time it was reversed. The legislature, they stood up.
Janice, early in the speech, she acknowledged Native Americans, Native veterans, particularly women veterans. What did you make of that, and what did she say?
I thought it was very good that she addressed the veterans and the women that were with us today. Then she also spoke of the women veterans, the ones that broke the glass ceiling, the ones that have protected us. So I thought that was a good way to start her speech, because we all honor the veterans, and that's what she addressed. In our communities, they are very valuable to us, and they're honored, and so they lead out our ceremonies and our dances, and they are very much respected in all our communities. So I thought it was very good that she did that.
And I'm not sure that most Americans know that Native Americans have the highest per capita service in the military branches. 140,000 American Indians are serving in various military branches. 10% of those are women. And so it was very empowering, I think, to see an entire color guard march into the assembly chambers made up totally of women carrying the tribal flags and the eagle staffs and that sort of thing.
Patty, did it hit home in any way that, you know, ordinary people do extraordinary things? We heard that in the speech several times. Did you find that to be a theme that had continuity in this year's speech?
I think most Native people would say just the fact we're still here is pretty extraordinary. I don't mean to be flip about that, but we constantly find ourselves fighting for our languages, our cultures, our education, our environments, and I think that was a theme that permeated her speech today, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
Well, yeah, Janice, go ahead.
I was just going to agree with Patty and say I thought that she did a very good job of that, because some of the examples that she used, especially of the daily living type of life, that we're all people and that it's a, just an ordinary person in everyday living that can make a difference. And she addressed all those, the age gap, age span from the young people to the elders. So I thought that she did a good job.
Let's dig into the speech a little bit, starting first with conservation. Mm. And she said the tribes stand with Governor Walker's opposition to the defunding of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Talk a little bit about what else stood out to you on the issue on conservation. Patty?
Well, she mentioned the Back 40 gold mine, and that is an issue that the Menominee are very concerned about, along with non-native people as well. And if you understand the geography of that area, the 250,000-acre rectangle that the Menominee have in Menominee County, the Mohican Nation Stockbridge Muncie community occupies the southwest corner of that reservation. So this, they're very close to this mine as well. This is a sulfide mine. These kinds of mines are known to leak acid, and this is upstream from some sacred sites of the Menominee Nation, some burial sites. And so this is a really big issue for the Menominee and for other Native people as well. I would say the tribes in the state, I'm pretty sure that all of them at some point have issued mining impact statements and have stood in solidarity on that kind of mining, and to a lesser extent, iron mining as well. But the fact that she mentioned that, and that, I'm not sure. Do you know, has the state of Wisconsin taken an official position on that mine? I'm not sure that it has.
I have not heard.
Do you know?
I do not know either, but I know that it is, you know, the Menominee River, even though that it shares a border with Wisconsin, you know, certainly there is issues with Wisconsin having a say as well.
Right.
Yeah. We're talking right now about the 13th Annual State of the Tribes Address. Our guests, Patty Lowe and Janice Rice. Patty Lowe here in the studio is the professor in the UW-Madison Department of Life Sciences Communication and the School of Human Ecology, and Janice Rice, who is a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation, and she was the outreach coordinator for the college library at UW-Madison to her retirement in 2015. Let's move on now to the Wisconsin Act 31, which mandates that Wisconsin students are educated on tribal history and culture and sovereignty. Janice, what is the Wisconsin Act 31?
It's an act that addresses tribal sovereignty and teaching Indian culture, and also even getting into language in the schools. And Patty, do you remember what age levels that are specifically addressed?
I don't think it's specified in the act itself, but I think it's three times in the K-12 experience. But it also has some requirements for teacher certification. So any teacher that wants to teach in the state of Wisconsin has to have taken college credits that demonstrate that they have the capacity to teach that.
And what did President Holsey say about it?
She talked about changing it or revising it, updating it, because it's been how many years now, did she
28.
Say?
28. And it's unfunded.
Yes, it's been unfunded, so it's been from the good hearts of a lot of people that really value this, that it's carried along this far today. And so they're proposing to work together with Wisconsin Indian Education Association and revamp it and bring it to the legislature and have them take a look at it and address it in a more positive way towards pulling together some of the pieces that really haven't tied together in the past. And so they're looking at the community is getting together so that there's more probably funding to go with it, I would hope, so that there would be fuller representation in the curriculum for American Indians.
And Patty, what were some of your takeaways from this speech?
Well, having seen quite a few of these, this seemed to me to be less contentious. I think Shannon Holsey was more diplomatic. She was more conciliatory. It seemed like she took a lot of opportunities at, you know, in almost every part of her speech to point out those areas of common space where the state and the tribes actually have some common denominators, and pointing out that the state and the Indian nations are stronger together, that the problems both face are really the same problems. We all want, is at one point, I think she said, we all want to drink clean water, we all want to breathe clean air, we all want good education for our children, we want good health. And so that, and I don't know whether it was a tribal thing or whether it was a gender thing or what, but I'm thinking of some of the male tribal leaders that have delivered that address in the past, and they haven't quite been as kumbaya-esque as Shannon Halsey was.
Janice, how important is the State of the Tribes address and that lawmakers hear it?
I think it's important that they hear from the tribal leaders, because on a daily basis they're not in front of them. Occasionally we'll have some issues that arise that are rural and urban, and you'll hear maybe some parent or someone from a community address the legislature, but that's kind of rare. So this is a chance for them to hear straight from our tribal leaders the issues that we have at the top of our list. So I think it's a real good opportunity and a chance for also the legislators to show their support. And I see it every so often that, you know, when they stand and give the standing ovation, or they stand up, or they applaud. So I know they're hearing some of the words that are being said, and then the interaction afterwards. So there's a reception afterward, and sometimes there is some more interaction there, as well as being on the floor and talking a little bit more. So I'm seeing a little bit more of that than I have in the past. A little more talking afterward than I saw in the beginning.
Ah, so yeah, opening up a dialogue.
Yes,
yeah. And I think. We sometimes sovereignty has been framed as a barrier between the state and the tribes. You know, that's something, it's something that the state has to navigate or litigate. And I think what Shannon did very competently was to point out that tribal sovereignty can be a source of strength for the state too. In healthcare, for example, she pointed out that there are opportunities for the state to be reimbursed for services it provides, but only if the tribes are involved. And so there are these pockets of money that are available to tribal communities that aren't available to other levels of government. And I think she effectively pointed that out.
Janice and Patty, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
That was Janice Rice, member of the Ho-Chunk Nation, and she was the outreach coordinator for the college library at UW-Madison until her retirement in 2015. She was also an archivist for the Ho-Chunk people, and she's a past president of the American Indian Library Association. And Patty Lowe, who is a professor in the UW-Madison Department of Life Sciences Communication in the School of Human Ecology. She's an enrolled member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe, and is an affiliated faculty with the American Indian Studies Program. She's written several books on the Native American experience and history in Wisconsin. Janice Rice and Patty Lowe joined us to talk about today's State of the Tribes address.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, Antiques Roadshow is coming to Green Bay in June. We'll speak to the longtime executive producer of the show about its history and how you can have your treasures appraised.
First, 27-year-old Melissa Hall was pregnant when she was detained at the Milwaukee County Jail. She's now suing the county and Sheriff David Clark, who is in charge of the jail, after alleging that she was shackled when she was hospitalized for childbirth.
The federal lawsuit states that the jail has a, quote, blanket shackling policy, which requires all inmates to be shackled when hospitalized, regardless of circumstance. Hall is seeking class action status in the case.
Joining us now to tell us more is Teresa Kleinhaus. She's an attorney with the Chicago-based firm Lovey & Lovey, which is handling Hall's case. Teresa, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Teresa, can you give us an overview of why Melissa Hall is suing Milwaukee County and Sheriff David Clark?
Absolutely. Ms. Hall is proceeding on her own behalf, on behalf of other female inmates who are similarly situated, who were also in Milwaukee County Jail and were also shackled during their prenatal and care and childbirth and postpartum care. And she's suing on the ground that her constitutional rights were violated because of the jail's blanket policy. Essentially treats all inmates as though they are major security or violence or flight risks, even though women in labor, as I think everyone can imagine, are in no position really to flee, and therefore there's no reason to be shackling women during childbirth, especially given the county also includes two armed guards while women are giving birth. So that's the basis of the lawsuit.
And as you said, it's the jail's policy to shackle all inmates when they're hospitalized, regardless of the circumstances. Is the ultimate goal here a change or overturn of that policy?
Well, certainly we always like to see jail policies improve, but I would say on behalf of these women, you know, they're really looking to redress their own rights of what happened to them. And if that changes a policy in the jail and prevents it from happening to other women, that's certainly a goal as well. You know, they want justice for themselves and they want to prevent it from happening to other people.
You mentioned that this is going to be pursued as a class action lawsuit, that other women were in a similar situation to Melissa Hall. Do you know how many women and why maybe more of them haven't come forward to be named in particular in this lawsuit?
We estimate approximately 40 women or more would make up the class members. And, you know, I understand that it's an extremely traumatic experience for women to be shackled during childbirth and labor. And we're seeking the class action status because they all have, you know, similar constitutional claims and suffered, you know, similar damages and trauma as a result of this. I think you know, we're learning more about who all was impacted by this. Obviously, these are women who are already going through difficulties in life, you know, well before they're shackled pursuant to this policy.
During the birth, how did medical personnel respond to the fact that, in this case, Melissa Hall was in shackles?
Well, medical professionals are very much appalled by this policy. Ms. Hall's medical providers are very concerned about it, and other women that we know of who were also subjected to the same policy, their medical professionals were also asking to have shackles removed. And, you know, all of the medical organizations that have examined this issue, the American Medical Association, you know, the Association of Nurse Practitioners and Midwives, they've all said that this is a very dangerous practice. So there's no, obviously there's no medical reason to shackle a woman during labor, quite the opposite. And so it's quite alarming to the medical providers when they observe this.
You use the word dangerous. What kind of dangers are there for the personnel, or in this case, the pregnant woman?
You know, it's quite a range. And the reason for that is childbirth is a very dynamic process. Things can change very quickly in terms of the health and safety of the mother and the child. For example, an emergency C-section or a baby who has an umbilical cord wrapped around its throat, perhaps, you know, hemorrhaging. These are all things that have to be attended to rather quickly. And, you know, for a midwife or an OBGYN, a minute is a long time, and it might take as long as a minute to get a sheriff's deputy to unshackle someone and allow movement for that person.
And we've been using the word shackles, but I imagine there could be different versions of what that means. Can you walk us through exactly what we're talking about?
Sure. During the actual childbirth, it includes a wrist restraint, restraining one wrist to the bed, and a leg shackle, restraining one leg to the bed. So that's particularly difficult because when women are trying to push during labor, often they might be inclined to pull their knees towards their chest. That's something you can't do as well, obviously, if you're shackled. Or you might want to grip the bottom of a foot. You can't do that if your wrist is shackled. Similarly, you know, if you're going to, after giving birth, someone who wants to hold her new baby is, you know, going to have more difficulty doing that, or breastfeeding with those shackles. So those are the shackles that are on during childbirth. There's also a belly chain around the abdomen, that, and the wrists are then attached to that when a woman's walking, for example, to and from the bathroom, all of which, you know, can put her, you know, she's already sort of off her regular center of gravity because she's pregnant, and then you add heavy shackles. It's quite a dangerous practice.
Are there any instances that you know of where a woman in labor who has been wearing shackles has tried to be disruptive or to harm someone that is working with her, someone in medical personnel where these shackles may have been protective?
I'm not aware of any instances of that. You know, we've consulted with experts on this who have a lot of experience in correctional medicine, a lot of experience with women during childbirth. And the reality is women who are giving birth don't have the psychological or physical resources to suddenly become assaultive, by and large. I mean, I suppose, hypothetically, we could all imagine someone who is really suffering, you know, some mental difficulty, but we would submit that that would be a special case and wouldn't be a reason to have a blanket policy. And I guess a piece of that is that, again, there are armed deputies there, and women during childbirth are not going to be inclined to risk their own life or the life of their child to try and be assaultive at that moment.
Teresa, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Teresa Kleinhaus. She's an attorney with the Chicago-based law firm Lovey & Lovey, joining us there to talk about a lawsuit that her firm is pursuing against the Milwaukee County Jail after a woman said that she was shackled during childbirth.
I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7 on Latino USA, we hear from a group of elementary school children who fought to bring forgotten history back into their textbooks. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, for many fans of PBS, this is a familiar song. Uh-huh, that's right. That's the theme for the popular and enduring Antiques Roadshow. For years, people have been taking their treasures to be appraised by the show's crack team of experts. For some, their heirlooms aren't worth as much as they thought. And for others, their unassuming items are truly priceless.
It's a show that's been delighting viewers and participants since its debut. And Wisconsinites will get a chance to bring their antiques to be appraised when the show comes to Green Bay in June. And joining us now to talk about the show and why it works and how viewers can join the fun is Marcia Bemko. She's the executive producer of Antiques Roadshow. Marcia, welcome to Central Time.
I'm delighted to be here. And if you could see me, if you had like radio vision, you'd see that I still bounce around when I hear that music.
it's a perky song for sure. Can you tell us about how long you've been with Antiques Roadshow?
Well, here we are getting ready to shoot our 22nd season, and I have been with Roadshow since right after season 3 taped. So, a few years there. Hmm.
And how long has Antiques Roadshow, it's been on the air, you said, 21 seasons?
Yeah, we're broadcasting season 21 now, and we first started in 1997 touring in broadcasting, and we had we've actually been to your state. You were one of our early ones. We were there in season 3, which was 1997 was our broadcast year. 1996 was our first year of touring.
How has it evolved over the years? How have you seen it evolve?
Well, it's interesting. The show has evolved, and so has the field of antiques. You've watched us, and even if you've seen we've already revisited the Madison shows and the Milwaukee shows from our early ones, the vintage shows where we update prices. You can see all the learnings that as a production team we've had, and just like any other job, whether you're making television or you're making shoes, when you make your 10th pair of shoes, they're better than your first pair of shoes. So we have learned a lot over the years as producers. We've become our own kind of television experts in antiques. So let me give you a simple example. So when you first started watching the show, you may have noticed our experts didn't always tell you when they gave a value, whether that value was an auction value, a retail value, insurance. You didn't know. Pretty much now when you watch a show that's a new show that we've made recently, that's always there unless we've made a mistake. I mean, it makes a difference because an auction price of $10,000 can be the same as a retail price of $20,000. Mm-hmm. So we've learned that kind of thing. And then as far as the public's concerned, even the kinds of items that we see over the years, it's quite different. So in the early years, our pottery and porcelain line was huge. Now it's still a good line, but I think the paintings line will beat that.
Do you ever get worried when you set off for a new location that this is going to be the show where everyone just has worthless thimbles or tin plates and none of it's going to be worth anything and that you're going to have a clunker of a show?
You know, in the early days, I might have thought that, but now I have confidence that that won't happen. The statistics are with us. The day that we come, about 5,000 people will come to the show. And they will bring two objects each, and we will see about 10,000 items.
Wow.
And when you see that many things, and people who are coming are bringing, as one of our experts used to say, if the house were on fire and the family were safe, these are the two things they saved from the house. So they're bringing something they're really curious about. They're bringing often a family heirloom, something they think is, quote-unquote, really good. And so we get a chance to see, frankly, there's not enough camera time for all that we see.
Has there been a favorite city for you that you've traveled to for this show?
Not really.
Okay.
Every city has a personality. I will say that one of the things I like about your area of the country is your distinctive accents. Now, you're listening to me as a Bostonite saying, who has an
to
accent?
Laugh at that. Wait, yeah. We don't have accents. No accents here.
But I always know when we're watching our Madison shows and our Milwaukee shows, I don't need a city bug to tell me where I am. I can hear it.
Wow, that's fun. Well, we're talking right now with Marcia Bemko, executive producer of Antiques Roadshow. And Antiques Roadshow is coming to Wisconsin, coming to Green Bay in June. And we want to share a clip from the show. This is from a few years ago, but it seems to really capture people's imagination. It's an appraisal of a rare textile in Arizona.
This is the beginning of Navajo weaving.
Wow.
And not only that, the condition of this is unbelievable. Unbelievable. Wow. We see these. We've got a little bit of damage over there. We have
the damage.
Very interesting thing here. This is almost like silk. It's made from hand-woven wool,
yeah.
But it's so finely done, it's like silk.
Wow.
It would repel water. And this here is dyed with indigo dyes. It was a very valuable dye at the time. And what's really interesting is right here, we have an old repair that was probably done in the 1860s and is done with raveled bayeta, which is in itself a very important thing in Navajo weaving. So all involved, it's an extraordinary piece of art. It's extremely rare. It is the most important thing that's come into the roadshow that I've seen. Do you have a sense at all of what you're looking at here in terms of value?
I haven't a clue.
Are you a wealthy man, Ted?
No.
Well, sir, I'm still a little nervous here, I have to tell you. On a really bad day, this textile would be worth $350,000. On a good day, it's about $500,000.
Oh, my God.
You had no idea.
I had no idea. I just laying on the back of a chair.
Well, sir, you have a national treasure.
Wow.
A national treasure.
Wow, that clip is amazing. And according to Antiques Roadshow, since it was originally appraised, that Navajo Ute blanket is now appraised between $750,000 and $1 million. Do you remember that one, Marcia?
That's Ted from Tucson, so yes, do I remember that. And I'm sitting in a booth with no notes. That was an amazing day. I was there that day. It was an amazing discovery. It's a very rare Navajo weaving. And when this is the privilege of my job, is how many wonderful and rare objects I have seen, been able to touch. Yes, go ahead, eat your hearts out. I've touched a lot of those things you've seen. And I'll never forget it, because I talked to Ted afterwards, because that was something that his foster grandmother had handed down to him. He had retired. He had very little money. He was living in a trailer home, and this was a life-changing moment for him. Mm. He is one of our rare guests, because most don't, no matter what it's worth, but I happen to know that he did sell that to a museum. Oh, in a private sale. Yeah. So life-changing for him.
And you get a glimpse inside of people's lives and the pieces that they have collected along their journey. How does that feel for you as the executive producer to weave these stories together? And even though there's a dollar amount involved, you are really, at the end of the day, telling stories.
We're telling stories, and they're very intimate stories. We are basically rummaging around in your attic, in your underwear drawer, in front of 8.5 million people. And that is something where people, our guests who come in, they're willing to share their stories with us. And all of us on the production, and I'm sure all of you at home who've watched Roadshow, have cried with our guests. They are very attached to the objects. They're family heirlooms. They mean more than money to them. They're glad to know. They may want to get some insurance now so that in case something happens. But for the most part, they're really touched by the discovery, touched by, frankly, not even learning if it's just money, but they were wondering, is this from Connecticut, or did my parents get this when, or my great-great-grandparents get this while they were in Europe still? So to answer those kinds of questions for them, it is very personally satisfying, and it's emotional for us, even those of us who have a thicker skin, who we've been on the show for a while. It doesn't, no pun intended, that doesn't get old.
You said earlier that it's more rare for the item in question to be sold than it is for it to be kept. Does that surprise you at all? I mean, you think at the end of the day, this is also about money, and sometimes people really need money. What is it about those objects that makes them so precious?
It surprised me when I first came to do the show, and I thought, oh my God, if I owned that, I'd sell that. Well, that's because it wasn't my great-great-grandmother's object. I've learned over time that people just won't unless they have a real need. And there's a good reason for that. When you hear our experts, as I explain, they give you context for price. You know, is it auction or retail? No matter where you sell it, even if you do an online seller, very inexpensive, there's a cost to sell. There's always a cost to sell. So whether, you know, unless you have something of huge value, an auction house might waive your buyer's premium, but pretty much you're going to pay something to sell it. So the day you sell it, you can't afford to buy it back. A fair price for a retail person to pay you is just like any other retail, half of what it would retail for. And so you can't afford to buy it back from him if you could find it. And so with unique family objects, or things that are unique to that family anyway, they are very careful before letting them go, because for the most part they are not 20 years old and they understand and value their history. I've been green with envy when I see guests come in with objects that have been in their family since the 1600s. I don't know about either of you, but I don't have that. Yeah, it's pretty rare, and it's what an amazing thing.
We're talking with Marcia Bemko now. She's the executive producer of PBS's hit show, Antiques Roadshow. It's coming to Green Bay in June.
And you can join the conversation. What are some of your favorite moments from the show? What question do you have about having your items appraised? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. And just a heads up, we won't be able to appraise your items on the air.
And we'll continue our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation about PBS's hit show, Antiques Roadshow, with its executive producer, Marcia Bemko. And the program will be coming to Green Bay this June.
And what questions do you have about the show? Want to share some of your favorite memories of the show? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. And please remember that we can't appraise your antiques here on the air.
Let's take a caller now. We've got David joining us in Waukesha. David, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I was just calling to say that it must have been at least 10 years back. My wife and I went to the road show when it was in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm. And what was that like?
And it was really amazing. The number of people that were waiting to go in, I forget the name of the building, but it wrapped around the entire outside of the building.
Wow.
People waiting to come in this long queue. And I can't remember what my wife and I brought, but I can tell you that it was fascinating to see all the stuff that people had that were standing in line in front of us or behind us, and how we're all exchanging information about what we thought it might be worth and the history. It was just fascinating to see the things that people were bringing in to have appraised.
David, that's really cool. I had no idea that the line wrapped around the block, but, you know, hearing that people are in the thousands when they come to this, Marcia, it sounds as though there's almost this informal little community that grows up around a particular show. Is that right?
That's right. And what David's describing, I'm sitting here grinning. I think he's probably talking about we were there in 2006 for our season, in season 11. People do start get friendly in line. They show each other their objects. They start to talk. There's like a little party going on. What I hope is that we do a good job and not have you waiting in long, long lines. But, you know, inevitably there are some lines. But that is a very common experience. What we hope doesn't happen is that the thing you didn't know anything about while you're waiting in line, that the person ahead of you doesn't appraise it before you come in. But other than that, we're happy.
So, Marcia, how does the show find its experts?
We work with a group of about 150 experts, assigning approximately 70 to every venue. We find them, we're very careful. At this point, we have our veteran experts who you all know and have seen on our air for a long time. But every year, we do have to add new experts. People retire or no longer available to do the show. And when it comes time for finding somebody new, depending upon what category, is it paintings or collectibles, we will look among other experts. We often have people who are soliciting us, and they've been contacting us for a long, long time, wanting to be on the show. Something that everyone should understand about our experts, because it's a biggie, they donate their services to public television. They help put the public in public television. Mm. They donate their time. We do not pay them for any of the television appearances they make, and they also pay their own travel and pay their own hotel nights.
Oh, wow.
So they do this as a service. It's also, you know, been life-changing for them as well. But they've learned a lot on the show, too. And they like, they're constantly hungry for that kind of learning. And so we choose them. When we do choose somebody new, we check them out very, very carefully. We do background checks. We do gossip checks. We want to make sure, because we know once we put that person on our roadshow set, you will trust them. And we're going to make sure that they're worthy of that trust.
Oh, that's good to know. Wow. Let's take another phone call here. We've got Gail joining us in Madison. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I have a question. I'm not looking for an appraisal. I have an antique carved tusk that's been in the family for about 60 years, and I don't have papers for it. Is there anyone on the roadshow that would have the expertise to date that?
Did she say tusk? Did you say tusk?
An elephant tusk.
It is a tusk,
very,
yes, an ivory tusk.
Very elaborately carved, and it's been in the family, you know, sitting on its stand for about 60 years, and, you know, it gets passed down, but the paperwork has never been passed down. And I understand it's illegal to sell something that is newer than that, and I'm wondering if on the roadshow you have someone that would be able to give me a value and also a date.
We do, our experts who are in the Asian arts are able to assess your tusk. It's not an object that we will air anymore. It's illegal, and frankly, even if you, in certain states, and it varies by state, I frankly don't know what the laws are in your state for ivory, but they do vary by state, and in some states it's not legal to cross state lines with it. And you're right, you do need some paperwork. To really do anything with that object. It's tricky, and I don't have a simple answer for you. One thing you could do is if you go to the Antiques Roadshow website, pbs.org/antiques, and you look up our experts who are there in Asian arts, and you'll see those who you've seen on our air, including Lark Mason, Dessa Goddard, et cetera, and email them and ask them, because they're dealing with this question all the time. You know, this is something that was, up until more recent years, traded quite commonly in the market, and under certain conditions does still trade. But it's dicey, and I don't even know all the rules. It's tricky. It's very, very tricky.
Gail, good luck, and thanks so much for calling in. Let's now go to Richard in Milwaukee. Hi, Richard.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Well, I'm a huge fan, just like everybody is, so thank you for your work. It's a phenomenal show. The question I have is, I've tried to get tickets before. In fact, when the show came to Milwaukee, I believe, a number of years ago, I tried to get tickets, and it seemed quite complicated, and, well, I wasn't sure how to traverse it. Could you just give us a general idea when you come to a city of how to go about getting a ticket?
Of course. Right now, up until April 10th, so you have, six more days, where you can go onto our website and register for a pair of tickets. Now, what we do in every venue that we are visiting, we're going to give out 3,000 pairs of tickets, so 6,000 pairs to people like you who are putting in for those tickets. Now I get to boast. For me, it's a boast. For you, it makes your odds a little harder. I get to boast, as of 3 p.m. today, how many people have applied for tickets in Green Bay? That would be 15,416.
Oh my gosh.
Hot off the press's info.
Oh, my goodness.
So what happens when you apply is you have to hope that Lady Luck is with you. Or you could apply to a different city, but, you know, actually if you... Portland right now is in the lead. That's the last city we're going to. This is a very population-driven thing, folks. And they've got over 21,000 applicants there. So that is very typical for roadshows. So it can be hard sometimes to get a ticket. I know stations, and I'm not sure, you know, they can run out quick, and I'm not sure where your station is at this point. The stations do have some tickets available for pledging, which is, you know, a donation to your station. I'm not sure if this station has any left. They tend to go quickly, and they may be gone by now, so I don't know the answer to that. Get on our website and apply, because guess what? We do pick 3,000, and you could be one of them.
It sounds sort of like getting tickets for Hamilton.
maybe
harder than getting tickets for Hamilton.
It could be harder.
At least in Wisconsin.
Ours is free, though. We won't charge
you. Right, yours is free. That's a good point. Well, good luck, Richard. I hope you get in this time. Good luck to you.
I hope you do, too, Richard.
And, Marcia, you know, we've been talking about, another theme. We talked about storytelling. Another theme is history. Do you feel and do you think that the people who come to you and learn things, just briefly, do you think they feel more connected to their history and the roots that came before them?
I believe so. And from the audience that we do hear from, they tell us that. I if you watch a season of Roadshow and you don't learn when the Civil War happened, you didn't have the audio on. You're going to learn something about our country, even if you don't want to. You sort of learn by this, it's like a spoonful of sugar. You can't help but learn. And, you know, for me, that's fascinating. Finding out about places like the Spiral Jetty. Who knew? You'll learn that in our Salt Lake City episodes that are airing now. That kind of thing is, I know I'm enjoying
and
it.
Marcia, and Marsha, I'm sorry we're out of time. Thank you so much.
Can't wait to see you all.
Thank you.